Hello, and welcome to Geek Between the Lines, the podcast that explores compelling ideas in some of our favorite geeky properties. I'm Brittany.
And I'm Chris.
And this week we're continuing with our watch through of The Magicians, and we're looking at season 4, episode 3, The Bad News Bear. Chris, can you give us a recap of what happens?
Sure. The gang reunites, but a returning Margot finds out Elliot is being possessed. She stops the monster's attack by making a deal with him to help him kill Bacchus. As Bacchus's friend, Josh is unwillingly made to poison Bacchus with ambrosia, which he morally struggles with but finally accomplishes after Margot forces him to. In order to placate Marina, the gang on Earth need some library-powered Dewey coins, so they work with luck magician and counterfeiter Frankie. After Quentin wins some starting power through a magical card game, Katie and Penny go to retrieve a black card and Dewey's using a luck spell. The luck spell is balanced via a teddy bear, which results in whoever holds the teddy bear experiencing all the bad luck. The spell fails to override Julie's divinity, so Quentin takes it. Meanwhile, Alice stays at the library to find her friend's books, ends up kidnapped while Santa escapes through a chimney. At the end of the episode, the monster kills Bacchus and takes an orb from inside his body, Katie takes over the apartment and adopts a puppy, and Quentin listens to the bad news voicemail about his father.
So, amazing episode. Mm-hmm. Why don't we go into some of our magic moments, which I have way too many notes on.
Absolutely.
But you can start.
Yeah, I mean, first off, just the great small good and bad luck things that we see throughout the episode.
So good.
Are just delightful. And how Frankie is just used to the good luck all the time is really, really great.
Can I be a luck magician?
I know.
I would love to have encrusted myself with luck. Not that I want other people to have bad luck. Well, maybe certain people. Like, certain people in our government. But... I just, you know, he drives up in a car with a huge bow on it. Like,
exactly. He parks in front of a
fire hydrant.
A bird delivers him sandwiches. Yes.
Just, someone knocks on the door at this apartment that's not even their apartment that he's visiting. He's like, oh, it's probably for me. A huge check and everything.
Not now, guys.
Yeah.
Very good.
It would just be such a great way to...
live your life?
Yeah. And redistribute the wealth. If you're winning all of the lotteries, then you can just change the world.
Yeah, exactly. But I also love the bad luck parts, like everything from the spoon falling into the soup.
I know, the lowest stakes bad luck.
Exactly. And then paper cut from tissue, and then a snake comes up the toilet.
Yeah. That is somehow wrapped around him, which is so gross, too.
Yeah, yeah. Things falling all over. Yeah, it's just very, very good. I also loved amazing, amazing lines. Marina's... I'm assuming it's a he because this is some toxically masculine behavior. Delightful. And then, you know, she talks about how there's a monster inside her apartment. She says, so instead of going inside, I'm going to get a breakfast burrito. Want to join? Like,
I know.
Such a great Marina line.
But it's also great because it shows that even though these people are in her apartment, that yes, she is willing to sell to the McAllisters if it'll get her... access to more magic, but she's also like, maybe you don't want to die, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, she's still friendlier than the Marina of, you know, this timeline, because I don't think that Marina would care if Margot wants to join her burrito, but she actually seems happy and willing to build relationships in a way.
Exactly, rather than just, don't go up there, I'm leaving.
When Alice and Santa are arguing and she tells him to stop doing the Santa stuff, and he's like, can you stop with the angsty, nerdy stuff? No, because that's who you are, and I don't judge you for it.
Yeah, okay.
When they're talking about why they can't back Quentin up at the card game, and Penny just goes, I just don't want to.
Although he's made to.
Yeah, he does anyway, but, you know, that's just such a good one.
And the fact that Katie has been banned from all of these, which is just, I want to know the background of that. What did she do?
Yeah. And then, of course, Penny's mustache.
I mean, both of their ridiculous costume outfits, like, I love that they're wearing them because if nobody notices, that means, like, the luck is still working in their favor. But they're just, like, the worst disguise outfits ever. I feel like Penny looks like a soccer mom Luigi. And then the person's like, you have a fresh look. Have you thought about modeling? I'm like, Penny could model, for sure. But this is not a fresh look.
No, no, it's very, very much not. And then just a couple in fillery, we've all peed in things we regret. A very Bacchus line.
Very Bacchus line. Doesn't understand that most of us haven't done that.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And then there's a lot of really amazing Monster Elliot in this episode.
Oh, so good.
But the most humorous line for me, for sure, was, get to it then. Oh, and if they have pizza, get me some.
Yeah.
It's like the ominous desire for pizza.
Yeah.
Yes.
He's like, go poison this god, and also, if there's pizza, I need some.
Yeah, so good.
Yeah, another one I loved from him is when he's actually extracting the thing out of Bacchus. He's saying that he doesn't know who he is, and Bacchus took something from him, and Bacchus says, you don't know who you are? And the Elliot monster says, the word monster has been thrown around.
So hurt by it.
Yeah. Oh, I love it.
What other magic moments did you have?
I love when they're stealing the black card. And, you know, of course it's Penny. So charming to distract this person. And it's just so funny because Penny is, like, so charming to us in how disgruntled he is. But just seeing him be able to just turn it on, you know, and
it immediately being effective.
Yeah, with a complete stranger. And yes, gives also a little window into his previous life, I think. And Katie with pickpocketing, and, you know, they work quite well together. Also, just a great monster moment, because everything that he does is funny, in a way. At the very least, amusing, because it's Elliot, and it's not Elliot, clearly. But just at the very beginning of the episode, you just see how much power he has and how sadistic he is. The fact that he just automatically stops Penny from being able to travel.
Yeah, a great moment.
Did he just sense it? He sensed that he could travel, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And then also his witch to kill first. And you keep looking at him like you don't want him to die. Therefore, he has to go before you. And Quentin, you care about all of them, so you have to go last. And oh, Josh, with your round little baby face, you might be the most disturbing, so we'll start with you. And just, you know, the flick of his hand and he starts dying, you know. So just such a great way to start the episode. I also love Julia confronting Dean Fogg.
Oh, yeah.
It's just so good. She is just not having it. She will not allow him to make excuses. She's like, to be clear, you put the targets on our back. And you know what I had to give up to bring magic back. And this is what you did with it. You know, she is just going at him in a really powerful way for someone who doesn't have the longer history that some of the other Julias had in other timelines with Fogg. You know, this is the Fogg that kicked her out, but then this is the Fogg that then tried to protect her when she didn't have her identity, but she didn't have her identity because of him and, you know, all of that. And so, yeah, it was just really great to see that relationship go from just him caring about her and trying to not right wrongs, because he can't right the wrongs that were done to her, but like trying to not have further bad things happen to her. And her is like, no, you're doing these things to us and you need to do better. Yeah, I think this is a great kind of not that it's the end of their relationship together, but a great culmination of all of these little things that we've gotten along the way. And after her confronting him about this, the next scene we see with Fogg is him going to warn Alice that if everyone got their identities back, the library could find that out in the books, you know. So him actually taking action based off of it. Could he have gone and changed the books? Probably he should have, but he at least did something more proactive than he had been in previous seasons.
Yeah. And that's something that Julie is good at, is getting people to be active.
Yeah, and I appreciated here, too, that Alice would rather stay where it's much more likely that she's going to get imprisoned again and change her friend's books than leave with Santa, which is good because, you know, Alice, you really screwed up.
Yeah.
But why don't we go into our next section, which is setting in society. What were you noticing?
Yeah, one thing that really became clear this episode was that Julia's inability to do magic wasn't because of the glamour spell, but because of something going on with her and her decision to give up her magic to allow them to turn magic back on. And so that fact that it's continuing, I think, is interesting and shows that there's, yeah, still more kind of metamagical things that are happening with her.
Totally. And, you know, how much she gave up. Like, she did give magic up, and thinking back to the first season, how much she was trying to do anything, even things, even self-harm, so that she could remember that magic existed and try to seek it. And yeah, it was a huge thing that she gave up. And so she's going to call out other people when they're not willing to sacrifice to try to do the right thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, of course, we learn a little bit more about how the library gives out power, how it rations power, and this new currency of magical power called Dewey's. And, you know, that's obviously, I think, very, very funny.
Well, and so great, because Marina's like, the famous librarian made up the decimal system. Like, famous is maybe not the word I would use.
Yeah, exactly.
But, yeah, it's great.
Yeah, I think if Alice was there, she would have gotten it, but these other characters, not so much.
Which is, you know, understandable.
But, yeah. And so, yeah, there's now a currency that is very interesting because it's a currency that just one of is very, very valuable, which we're so far away from in our society at this point, where, like, a dollar no longer is a big deal, but, you know, historically, a single dollar was a major piece of currency. That, it's just kind of an interesting, different way of thinking about currency in society. I'm certainly not an economist, but it just, yeah, makes my brain work in kind of new ways.
I'm like, why would you want to be? But also, the capitalist current, right? They are putting a monetary value on magic that used to be accessible to everyone. In a way, they are colonizing magic.
Well, that's interesting because I don't know if they are putting a value on it. I think that that's more like there's a barter system that is putting a value on it. Because it's not like the library is saying you can get one Dewey for whatever. It's more of like they're giving out a resource, and then a system around that resource is turning it into a currency.
True, but part of capitalist systems is scarcity.
True.
And when there's scarcity, you can jack up the prices to whatever you want.
Absolutely, yeah. No, I think that there's definitely some analogs to capitalism here. I just don't think that the library is creating a capitalist system.
No, I think it's much more the McAllisters.
Well, that's interesting because I don't think that the McAllisters are creating the system either. I think the McAllisters are just the elite at the top of the system.
Well, it's hard to know because it's like how in these push games did they acquire these Deweys, right? So I'm thinking that they had to from people with black cards.
Well, I think that you can get Deweys rationed to you from the library, and then you can choose what to do with those Deweys. But the McAllisters don't have to make those kinds of requests. They can request however much they want for any purpose they want.
But I don't think that the library would give Deweys to people who have underground gambling games.
For sure. So they probably bought it from someone who did have a quote-unquote more legitimate reason. And that's, I mean, how black markets occur in our society, too. You know, more than half of the cigarettes sold in the world are sold in untaxed forms because, yeah, it's a way of taking what is a legitimate business and turning it into an illegitimate one.
Well, legitimate versus illegitimate based off of the laws that rich people make.
Of course, yes. But yeah, it's just, I think, very, very interesting seeing all that dynamic at play. And as you mentioned, the black cards, you know, those I think are the utmost example of how this is a new form of economic hierarchy. Mm-hmm. You know, that's very much tied to the way capitalism works in our society, where black card credit cards actually do exist, that have no upper limit, that have no other kinds of things, and they're extremely valuable, extremely rare, and only there for people who, like, the banks trust will never have to default on their purchases and the things they buy on credit, because they just have so much money and valuables that they don't have to worry about having, you know, the oversight that banks have that people don't spend too much on credit.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the idea of credit itself being, you know, tied to modern day capitalism and the inherent inequalities that come with that are also, you know, interesting in comparison with, yeah, the McAllisters being the only people who are able to, yeah, live a magical life free from a system that rations it out.
Well, and I mean, it's just the fact that it's not just unlimited access, but it's also no questions asked, which for money, you know, is bad enough, but for magic, where, like Katie was talking about, are we really going to give Marina all of this magic, basically give her a nuclear bomb, you know? Because you could do any number of horrific things with that much stockpiled magic, and this family just gets it.
Mm-hmm.
And not only just this family, but a family of enslavers,
exactly,
like, who have already done some of the worst things that you can do, so.
Yeah, and that really highlights the extent to which this was a devil's bargain for the library, that they were doing what they, you know, what Zelda at least thinks was the right way to protect society, but they didn't have the capability of doing it without the help of someone who is just unredeemably evil, like the McAllisters. And so they're in that bargain, and the McAllisters benefit from that bargain.
Yeah.
The other thing for setting in society, of course, have to talk about is Push.
Oh, yes. So good.
Such a cool, cool game. Like, oh, I loved every second of it.
Yeah.
It
was one of the reasons this episode is one of my favorites.
Yeah. It's
so good.
So good. Because, yeah, it's the, you know, the game is about how to magically cheat, how to magically change odds, and how to deal with the repercussions of that occurring. You know, it's almost like it's like a quantum deck. The next card could be any card.
I have no idea what that means.
Like quantum mechanics.
Oh, got it. I thought you were referencing something specific.
No.
I'm like, I don't play magic or whatever you're talking about.
No. Like, it is a deck full of possibilities. It's a deck that is not defined until a card is flipped. And
when it's the rules for poker.
So good.
That's when you really get how awesome this game and how it can be used is.
Exactly, yeah. And it's so cool the whole time, you know, and things get more and more improbable. You know, the rules of a tie, having to throw the poker card into a hat and then play them like poker, like, you know, all of that. And I just love the whole sequence. And then I think it is a all-time Quentin moment when he uses all the magic in the room.
Yeah.
So that the last card draw will just be based off of actual luck or skill cheating without magic.
Yeah.
Which is what Quentin does here. And
that he already has the queen in his boot or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's one of the great things that, you know, we get introduced to Quentin as someone who's obsessed with magic in the sleight of hand version, because he's been so obsessed with Fillory. And so to have that aspect of his character also prove an advantage to him in this moment is just great.
And I think another great moment to show that magically he has grown from season one, because he's doing some sort of weather type of spell, which is what he was doing at the Welters game. So, yeah, it's a nice callback to very early Quentin in this show.
Yeah, absolutely. What were your Sitting in Society moments?
Yeah, so I have a few small ones, like the continuation of treating magical creatures like tools or services, because lo and behold, Quentin just wagers Penny's exclusive traveling services for this game that he hasn't even played before. It's just a continuation, and it's so frustrating to me. It wasn't, what if this isn't, this amulet isn't enough? What else can we do? Penny, would you be willing to, you know? And it, and like a month. And the fact that it's not just traveling people, it's exclusive services. Like, people could ask him and he has to agree to do heinous things.
Yeah.
And just that using his abilities as a bartering chip without his consent, without asking first, and him finally agreeing, because Penny 23 is still Penny. And yeah, I was just so frustrated with that moment, because it's one thing if he wants to volunteer himself, which Penny often does to save people. But yeah, anger.
Yeah, absolutely.
Another super cool moment, though, was when Alice uses the anti-magic paint on the magic lock.
That was cool.
And just thinking about how is anti-magic paint created, and the fact that it's magic, but it's magic that precludes other magic, which is, yeah, just fascinating. Also, the idea of distilled ambrosia being able to greatly hamper gods, that kind of giving more context to when Hades was explaining that magic is a carrot that gods dangle in front of magicians to keep them in line, because it's like, okay, well, why do you need to keep magicians in line? Well, I mean, not that it's not difficult to access. Marina said that she had to call in every favor from everyone to be able to acquire this. But compared to, you know, the god-killing bullet, which they literally had to get from the magic of a demigod, right? It's probably easier to come by. And, yeah, the fact that some magicians have figured this out, and that would be a direct threat to gods, is really interesting.
Yeah, and it also highlights, again, Marina's competence, that she's able to get a hold of this, because this is a world that not only has a limited amount of magic available, it's not her world, and yeah, she's able to get this extremely valuable, extremely potent item for use in the defense of her home. Like, it's just, I think, another great Marina detail.
Absolutely. And the fact that, yeah, probably a lot of these people she was calling on, she's not going to tell that she's Marina 23. She's just going to be like, I'm Marina. And maybe they would have heard of her death or something. She's like, well, I didn't, you know, and then it makes her even scarier.
Yeah.
Another thing I loved was just this little tiny snippet of this alternate timeline self, and how these identities that were put on them with the Flock of Lost Birds, they have these completely different phones, right? The one that has Hansel as his wallpaper, you know, something Penny would never have. But then Penny 23's password is the same as Penny 40. And so just such an interesting thing that, yes, they're different, and yes, they've gone through very different things, but there are certain he experiences in their life and preferences and everything that would come through no matter how different their timeline was, I think is, yeah, just very interesting.
Yeah, that's a great point.
And I loved that you get a little bit more of a snippet into Penny's background, the fact that he was friends with Frankie before Break Bills.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I just love their relationship. We only get such a small amount of it. But the fact that Penny contacts him, he shows up immediately, and it's so clear that he actually likes this person. Mm-hmm. And they have this longer standing relationship. And he's laughing about how cherry soda.
Yeah.
Yeah, like it had to be a specific brand. Mm-hmm. You know, like he's like, I know.
So
you know,
good.
It's just, I love how quickly they built this relationship that we don't get to see, which, you know, if they want to do a spinoff show, I am there for.
Absolutely.
Amazing. But I think it also is tapping into the kind of what you were talking about when systems are so unequal, people have to resort to things that are outside of, quote, legality.
Mm.
And I imagine that's how Penny and Frankie met, that they would do these counterfeit things together. Penny, being a psychic, had great abilities, I'm sure, that he could bring to knowing what was going on and when to do things and how to do them or what the person's thinking, especially if they're dealing with muggles, essentially,
yeah.
You know? And so, yeah, I just think it gives a really interesting look at Penny found someone magical before he made it to Break Bills, even though he didn't get formal education in magic, you know, and maybe before Frankie even had as much luck ingressed into him. So, you know, everything didn't just work out for them too, maybe at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And also, yeah, like we were talking about, that Katie had been banned from Push, the seeing both of these characters who we've talked about being economically certainly marginalized and Penny in more ways as well. Well, and Katie as a woman and whose mother was a sex worker and
yeah.
You know, all of these things that help bond them, that both of them already had some experience in like kind of black market magic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to getting to Break Bills.
Yeah.
And also, yeah, a continuation of what we've kind of talked about for Margot and her growing, changing feminism.
Mm.
That before, you know, very much sex positive, female sexual liberation and things like that, but still using oppressive language or taunts and things like that, that are only anything because of misogyny. And now we have her getting into doing the opposite. So when Josh comes out and he didn't give the ambrosia to Bacchus, she says, "You nutsacked out, didn't you?" And he looks like, "Wait, what are you?" And she's like, "What, pussy makes more sense?" And then she's like, "Unless you start acting like a pussy and take one for the team," you know, she mm-hmm. is actually using language, one, more logically.
Yeah.
in what the vulnerability and what things do in these bodies, this is much more accurate, but only because of misogyny it has been reversed, right? And so she's just not gonna have it, and she is going to use this language that no one else around her is using and not care if they're confused or don't like it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
She's just like, "No, I'm going to actively start undoing some of this language that puts my whole gender at a disadvantage in this society."
Yeah. Yeah.
I appreciate.
Yeah. And very much mirrors her coming into her own power.
Mm-hmm.
And rejecting the marginalization based off of her gender and all that we've seen of her. You know, I think it's a really good attribute to an example of her growth.
Absolutely. But why don't we move into our next section, which is themes and schemes. What are you thinking about?
Yeah, I'm thinking a lot about Josh's statement to Margo about how she can be a good friend and a bad friend at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And we obviously see some discussions around that idea. Margo is trying to be a good friend to Elliot while being a bad friend to Josh. Josh is being forced to be a good friend to Margo and Elliot by being a bad friend to Bacchus. And, you know, he struggles with that. It's pretty difficult for him.
Mm-hmm.
Then we see the monster talking about how he thinks that that's his problem. His dilemma is that he is always trying to be friends, but is a bad friend.
Trying to align himself with Margo.
Mm-hmm.
I relate to you. It's like, that's not what she wants to hear, because you kill someone over sprinkles.
Exactly, right? She says, one way of making friends is not killing everyone you meet. And he's like, you get it. Exactly.
Did that just bring you right back to a very Potter musical?
It's here in my notes? Absolutely, right?
Yeah.
You hope killing people will make them like you, but it doesn't. It just makes them dead.
Yeah, exactly. So good.
It's excellent. So yeah, I think that there's some interesting things here about, you know, obviously a lot of relationships that are strained because of these circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And the monster is so defined by his need for love and relationships.
Yeah.
And yet his sadism, his desire to do whatever he wants, but also his understanding of what will hurt people best. Even if that's, yeah, the pain itself is not the intention until he has a rationale for it. But I did also think about Fog with this idea of being a good friend and a bad friend.
Mm.
And as you mentioned, Julia calling him out, you yeah. know, because, yeah, he is trying to protect people. He is trying to make these deals, these compromises to save the lives of his students. But in making those deals and compromises, he's also hurting those students.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and him visiting Alice, I think, is another good example of this. Of, you know, he goes in to try to give her some advice, but she doesn't trust him still, understandably. Yeah, I think that the fact that he betrayed these people to protect them, you know, that was his intention, was, in a way, him trying to be a good friend, a good, you know, relationship, but being bad in actuality. And yeah, I think it's interesting when, especially you have such a huge ensemble cast, and we see that not every character is close with every other character. Mm-hmm. Like, there are some relationships that are close and some that are not. Margo and Quentin will do anything for Elliot, but not everyone else will.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of, you know, sure, there's still the gang, they still are working in concert most of the time, but definitely not all the time. And oftentimes they do have different priorities or different goals. And when those work in contrast with one another, in conflict with one another, they will be bad friends to one another. But not because they want to hurt one another, just because they have other priorities. And yeah, I think it's interesting to see those dynamics at play between this cast. And I think the season we're going to see lots and lots of that, as especially Elliot is possessed,
mm-hmm.
which really comes to the fore in this episode.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I kind of wonder if, at least in this episode, the only person who is a good friend and not a bad friend to anyone is Penny.
Mm.
He doesn't even have a great relationship with these people. I mean, he doesn't even have a long-standing relationship with these people. And the person he was most connected to in his timeline is Julia. And Julia's not even there. And when his time and abilities are bargained away, he stays with it. You know, he's a traveler. He doesn't need the cloaking spells and stuff as much as other people do. And even with Frankie, You know, he could probably just go off with Frankie, do stuff and, you know, not
just
have
being
to
around
deal
him,
with...
he'll be okay.
Yeah, exactly. As well as when he brings Frankie into this, he's not trying to bargain his rate down. Mm. You know, I think that Penny is being such a good friend to everyone. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe the other person in this episode, oddly enough, considering why they are where they are, is Alice. Mm. Because she not only takes a big risk by letting Santa go, but she also encourages him to go and not wait for her, as well as she stays to try to cover the tracks of her friends. Mm-hmm. But everyone else, I feel like, does have good and bad friend elements, certainly in this episode, which also, like, I found a little frustrating from Josh that he's putting this pronouncement of she's being a bad friend to him and a good friend to Elliot. But I'm like, Josh, you're being a bad friend. It's only with her suggestion of Bacchus that you didn't die. Mm-hmm. You were being killed and she offered up someone else. Without that offer, all of them would have been killed. Monster Elliot was going to kill them all.
Yeah. Was in the act of killing you.
Yeah. And he doesn't have any gratefulness for her saving his life. Mm. And the fact that he angrily tells her that Elliot's probably dead anyway. So, like, why are we killing my friend? And I'm just like, I'm sorry. Her connection with Elliot and their friendship is so much deeper than anything you have with this god that didn't even care you didn't have magic, mm-hmm. didn't bring you along to Fillory, hasn't talked to you in months and months and months, and it's just like, oh, hey, you're here, we can party. I'm sorry, but those parties are not the building blocks of really deep, meaningful, I will help you all of the time in whatever you need. Josh has a problem, I think, too. He was trapped in a pocket world for a long time because he didn't even notice the quote-unquote friends around him were just worshipping him and were, like, minions of a demon, you know? Because he, like, wanted to believe that, which to me says that he doesn't really have any deep, close friendships. Mm-hmm. And, you know, which can be sad in its own right. But Margot is having to see her best friend, the main person in the world that she loves, the one that she spent more time with than any of the others here, and that they've had to rule together and they've had all of these hardships to overcome, and she's seeing him possessed by this monster. And he's just going to be like, well, he's probably already dead. I don't know. I actually got really irritated this watch through. Because before I just took his words of like, oh yeah, she's being a bad friend to him, but a good friend to Elliot. But I'm like, no, you're being a bad friend because you'd rather save Bacchus, who, one, has lived forever thus far. And two, doesn't really care about you that much. And like, you just party together at the expense of all of the rest of your lives, you know? It's not just Elliot's life that Margot is saving here. She is saving all of their lives. And part of that is the hope that Elliot's life is included in that. But at the very least, it's all of the rest of them, you know? And so I understand that you wouldn't want to set up this person that you know and like and enjoy spending time with for being killed, obviously, of course. But calling her a bad friend while he's being a bad friend to all of them was just a little too much for me.
Yeah, that's a really great point. Yeah, and it is true that Margot does what Margot does and, like, isn't exactly nice about telling him he has to go kill his friend, you know? She uses a harsh tone and is, yeah, not exactly the kindest person in the cast, but
of course not.
At the same time, that is one of the things that is what's great about Margot as a leader is that she doesn't have the time for the niceties. She has time to get the things done. And that's why when they're all standing there, she's the one who saves them. She's the one who immediately is the one who starts making deals, who starts to do something. It's not, and she's the one who would have the closest relationship with Elliot, you know, other than Quentin, maybe, you know, that's probably debatable. Exactly.
Yeah.
But she's not going in there trying to appeal to the monster. You know, she's going in there with a solution, and it's an ugly solution, but it's a solution. And after, being ruler for so long and having to do so many ugly solutions, like, that's a skill that she's grown, and it's what has allowed her to survive and thrive. And that's what's needed here. And so, sure, she's not, you know, being like, oh, I know this is hard, Josh, you know, it's, I'm sorry that you have to do this. Like, that's not a Margot thing to do, but that's also not what's going to help him get the things done, you know, and it does get done because of Margot here, not because of Josh.
Absolutely. And I think also part of the problem is looking at them as equals who are both being friends. Well, that's not all they are. And including the dean, it's like, Margot and the dean have responsibilities he has responsibilities to Breakbills and his students, not just these five or seven that he particularly was trying to protect, but to all of them. And so he made this deal, which is complicated and not good, and maybe prioritizing his school over other people, like hedge witches, in ways that it shouldn't be. But for what he was doing for his school, is he was trying to figure out, how do I continue instruction for magicians and keep Breakbills open and the professors be able to teach and all of that, and they need magic for that.
Yeah.
Right? And for Margot, not only is this saving all of their lives, but Bacchus is wreaking havoc in Fillory. He's leading to people's deaths and just so many problems. This is solving both of those, you know?
Yeah.
She doesn't only have the responsibility of being a friend. She is High King, and she has the responsibility of making sure, to the best of her ability, everyone in Fillory is safe.
Absolutely.
From these gods who really don't care and do what they want without consequences.
Yeah, so true. So what about you? What are your themes and schemes?
Yeah, I was kind of thinking about a couple. One just about identity, because that's what Monster Elliot is dealing with a lot of. Asking Bacchus, like, do you remember me? Because I don't remember who I am or where I came from. So that's the monster's journey. You know, that's his quest in this season. And as we talked about before, all of the identity spell goes all of them, and now they have that lifted. But now I think you also get a little bit of something else with Bacchus and Josh talking to each other, and Bacchus saying, like, we were born to be the perfect hosts, taking care of everyone else's needs. No one thinks what we need. I mean, it's like, you're a god, so what do you need? But but these roles that people are in, and that guiding a lot of their actions, including the dean and the High King. But Monster Elliot doesn't know what his roles are. He doesn't know what anything about him. And so him trying to search for that. I think identity can be such a huge thing in our world too, of what you identify with, what you like and dislike, what you believe in and don't, what you value, are huge for people. And sometimes when those things are taken away or change, unravel, you know, it could be from, you had an identity with a specific skill set, and then you're disabled in a way that you can't do that anymore, or any number of things. And so when an identity changes and you have to adjust to that, I think it can be really painful. And so, yeah, thinking about, obviously, the monster is doing terrible things, and it's not okay. Let's destroy other people in the search for my identity. But I think it is something that makes his actions more interesting to me.
That's so interesting, too, because this is also an episode that we start getting a lot of the characters referring back to what they were like when they were under the spell. Katie's thinking about that. Josh is thinking about that. Yeah. And, you know, they have, in many ways, had a kind of identity crisis hurled upon them. And being someone else for that much time, it has an impact. And yeah. It's really interesting seeing them, you know, deal with those impacts here. I think that'll probably be something that we'll all at least be keeping an eye on going forward.
Totally, yeah. Yeah, and I think Julia, too.
Totally.
She became a god. Her identity changed in a very specific way, and now she can't do magic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the other theme I was thinking about is kind of about sacrifice and what people are giving up.
Mm.
We talked about that a bit in the previous season with Quentin questioning whether the quest was asking him to, well, that was a lot of alliteration, whether the quest was asking him to sacrifice the people he loves, right? And we were talking about, like, no, it's sacrificing for something out of love, out of yourself, not sacrificing other people.
Yeah.
And I think we see a continuation of that here when, at the end of the episode, Julia is talking with Quentin. He says, you gave up being a god, I gave up my father, what did we get in return? And so it's bringing in this idea of, well, you only sacrifice for things when you get a benefit mm-hmm. from it, which, you know, is very individualistic and a very problematic way to interact with the world. Julia is the opposite here.
Yeah.
She says magic is back for almost everyone. And that means the world is a little brighter, even if they don't know why. And she hates the library for what they did, but she knew what it cost and she would make the same decision because it benefits everyone else. It is a detriment to her. A significant detriment, not only because she gave up her magic and can't do it anymore, but because the McAllisters would be after her,
mm-hmm.
potentially. And yet, she doesn't regret that. She would do it again if it would help people more than having magic turned off, even though she hates the new system. But she says to him that he wouldn't do it again. Because it didn't come back. Magic didn't come back in the way that he wanted it to.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think it's just adding another aspect of an idea of sacrifice. And that if it's just for yourself so that you get something good in return, it's tainted in my point of view.
Yeah. Yeah, that's such a good point. It is just another example of how, like, Quentin...
How Julia's the best person?
Well, yes, absolutely. And how Quentin is delusional because, yeah, he thought that he would be happy or be willing and able to be in this prison forever with the monster. Like,
he can't even deal with having less access to ambient magic.
Exactly. Like, what sacrifice, like, would your sacrifice be worth it then? Like, of course not. And, you know, that would be him actually sacrificing himself in a way
mm-hmm.
and getting even less in return for it. Yeah. Oh, Quentin.
Oh, Quentin, 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 Quentin. Because that's the problem. In these stories that he's obsessed with,
they have an ending.
Yeah, exactly. You don't have to see the mundane negative aspects for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, why don't we go into our last main section of the episode, which is from another point of view. Whose POV were you thinking about?
Margo's.
I mean, of course. We were fighting over Margo.
Yeah, Margo in this episode is so great, as you can just see all the things that she's grappling with as she sees Elliot possessed by the monster.
Yeah.
You know, she coming into the room sees him and lights up, and Quentin, you know, very quickly takes her aside and was like, it's not Elliot. And, you know, having just spoken with Marina about the god level threat and the trap that Marina left to take care of it,
mm-hmm.
she, you know, you can see her eyeing that trap, but also immediately having to recalculate based off of, this is Elliot. And is Elliot still in there? And no firm answer of a yes or a no. And her need to find that out and her inability to.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I mean, amazing acting, a wonderful performance. Good.
The excitement that he's here to the just horror and welling up with tears and then just one slowly running down her cheek while she's not changing any other of her face expressions. Mm-hmm. She's like trying to hold it together. It makes you feel how this would feel if this was your most important person. You know, it's her significant other, not in the romantic sense, but in the life human sense, and to see them be so not themselves and you just have no idea if they're alive or not is excruciating.
Absolutely. It reminded me a lot of when he was in the duel with King Idri and she makes the deal with the Fairy Queen.
Mm-hmm.
Because, similarly, Elliot might be in danger, and she refuses to just let that happen. She searches for any possible thing that she could do to help. And we talked about this before, but Margot goes into deal-making mode, you know? She starts to bargain, mm-hmm. you know, using Bacchus and then using the Ambrosia as a gambling chip.
Yeah, I mean, and she's the only one that is thinking that quickly. I mean, Penny tried to travel with people and, you know,
mm-hmm.
he wouldn't let him. But everyone else is just standing there not knowing what to do. She's the latest on the scene, yet she already has something up her sleeve to work with.
Absolutely. And she continues to you know, use that to work with him. You know, I can get you Bacchus. Okay, it's not just getting you Bacchus. Well, I can use this Ambrosia for you. She's going step by step, and she's not going to back down. She's not going to admit defeat. She's not going to accept defeat.
Maybe it'd be easier if I just killed you. She's like, okay, we have Ambrosia. Mm-hmm. There's another idea.
Yeah, exactly. And, yeah, for her to, you know, be doing all that work to find a way out for everyone and, you know, give herself time to get more information from the monster about whether Elliot's still in there and what could happen there, which is so clearly also on her mind. Like, mm-hmm. this is not just a, and then you leave forever. Like, that's not the last step for her.
Yeah.
And that's just because, yeah, it's Elliot. And then, yeah, as we've talked about, to have Josh tell her that she's being a bad friend. Mm-hmm. And the monster to then tell her that he relates to her because of it. Like, mm-hmm. it's just, I can only imagine how painful that would be.
Yeah, and she's so strong throughout. She doesn't rise to any of it. She just gets done what she needs to get done. And when the monster's trying to bond with her,
mm-hmm.
she will not accept it, even if it's putting her at risk.
Yeah.
She's like, we could be friends. You know, I can be your friend instead. And she says, no.
No, she can't be both friends with him and with Elliot. Like, she can't do that.
No. You and I will never be friends. But then she adds, unless you let me see
exactly.
or talk to Elliot. You know, and so the first thing is what she really feels.
Mm-hmm.
We will never be friends. But I mean, to tell the monster that, you know? And unlike, I think, anyone else in the cast, if they told the monster that, I think he would potentially just kill them.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he can sense the fortitude in her mm-hmm. that he doesn't. Yeah, he obviously he knows he has control of the situation, but yeah, she tells him no. She's the first person to tell him no.
Mm-hmm. And it's so different than what Quentin was doing, which was just do you think that maybe at the end of this, I could have Elliot back? Hers is, no, you want something? Well, I'm not going to just give it to you. But there are possibilities if you give me what I want.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that shows her strength in bargaining, in negotiating. Even at a time when, as you're talking about, like, she's so clearly terrified of the monster. And so clearly overwhelmed with the emotion that the monster is speaking out of Elliot. And it's just such a unique situation that she's in that, you know, she would never have been able to, nothing like this had ever happened before.
Yeah.
And so for it to happen in this way and for her to react so quickly, but also portray all of those emotions in her performance is just like, it's amazing.
And then when the Elliot monster, like, touches her hair, like, it's just, it feels so intimidating and creepy and threatening, even if it's not exactly how he's doing it, but it's not how he's doing it. But thinking of the physical closeness of them when it's actually Elliot, and how both of them are able to interact in this incredibly special relationship and then interact in a way that feels so wrong and divorced from the Elliot Margot dynamic, I think is, just really impressive and, so tragic. I feel for her so much. I can't imagine what that would be like if it was, you know, you were possessed by this monster or my sister was possessed, you know. It's just so much.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Margot is such a key player in this season so far. And, you know, her emotional resonance with the monster, who's clearly one of the major antagonistic forces here, is just, it's so powerful and so compelling that I'm sure this will not be our last POV of hers in the coming weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that also for her, as she's trying to bargain for being able to see or contact Elliot, or maybe he leaves his body and then they continue to help this, you know, monster along with his plans. But the monster telling her, I don't want another body. Because I like how everybody looks at me in this body. It's clear that you have so much affection for this body. And so why would I ever want to leave it? Just how devastating that must be to hear that maybe the monster could leave it. And Elliot would still be alive. But as far as the monster is concerned, he never wants to leave it. Why would he ever want to leave it?
And it's your love for Elliot that's causing that.
Yeah, he's weaponizing Elliot against her and the rest of them, which is just... Oh. I was also thinking about her... In general, I appreciate Josh, but I'm kind of annoyed with him in this episode.
I've noticed, yeah.
Because... One, he wastes some of the ambrosia that's so hard to get, and that maybe in the future, if they determine Elliot is dead and gone, they would use to try to defeat this monster.
And, like, how does he know that Bacchus won't sense it once he's knocked it over? And, you know, it's such a moment of panic that could ruin everything.
Yeah. And what is it that you want to happen? You go out there and then the monster is like, okay, fine, you're going to do it. I'll kill you then, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Like, you and all of your friends.
Well, actually, probably what it would be is like, okay, well, I'm just going to torture Margot until you do it, you know? So he wastes this priceless thing. And then it goes out and he doesn't want to do it, right? And I understand not wanting to do that.
Absolutely. I feel for Josh a lot this episode.
But what she tells him is, take one for the team. Mm-hmm. And normally when people say that, it bugs me. But
because you hate teams?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I think it coming out of Margot, a person who has sacrificed so much, put her life on the line to help destroy Martin when he really wasn't after her specifically,
yeah.
You know? And she really only got involved because of Elliot and Q. And then she didn't bail on Fillory when she could have. And Elliot would have had to stay there alone. But she was like, no, I'm not forced here by magic, but I'm choosing to be here because it's my commitment. And then, you know, was treated so badly in Fillory, it mm-hmm. still didn't abandon it. And then she
loses an eye.
Exactly, to try to change this fairy deal, and she agrees to an arranged marriage that she doesn't want to do. You know, she's done so much. She sacrificed so much. And not just her, but Alice sacrificed her life. Penny sacrificed his so many times. He sacrificed and lost the battle with his billion-year contract. Yeah. Elliot has sacrificed so much. Julia, Quentin, Katie, they've all sacrificed so much. And Josh really hasn't made any real sacrifices mm-hmm. yet. Yet, he wants to be included as a part of the group and was sulking about not. But the group makes these hard choices and has to sacrifice so much to try to save the world from the next threat. It's not just this fun quest that you get to go on. And it's like, oh, we're questing to restore magic. Well, you want to be a part of the group? That might come with these terrible side effects, mm-hmm. you know? And everyone else has continually done it and really haven't complained about it. Even when their sacrifices are delusional, like Quentin's.
Mm-hmm.
Who we were talking about. And this is the first sacrifice he has to make. I mean, even he and Victoria left them to deal with Martin and Fillory mm-hmm. alone. And so, yeah, he's never really made a sacrifice for the world. Hasn't really even made sacrifices for the group. And they've all done that. And so I was just feeling how frustrated, on top of the fear and despair and overwhelm that she's feeling, but this frustration that I shouldn't even have to ask you to do this because we've all been making so many sacrifices and yet you're putting me in a position that then you blame me for being a bad friend, mm-hmm. you know? And it was to save his life and all of their lives, including Elliot's, where he just wants to sacrifice the potential Elliot because he's not good friends with him.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I could just, like, feel the frustration of, this is my person. This is some god that you're not close with and is just kind of, you've partied with a bunch.
And who I know is a dick.
Yeah, yeah, and who's messing things up in my kingdom, you know? And this is the only way potentially out of death by the monster. And you're making me the bad guy, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, who was your POV character if it wasn't Margot?
Besides Margot.
Yeah.
the other person I was really thinking about here was Katie.
Oh, yeah.
The episode starts and the monster so... Not that the monster would ever care to be sensitive, but so insensitively says, oh, the way that she's looking at him makes me think that she cares a great deal about him, which is just a painful thing to have said when this is Penny 23 and not her Penny.
Yeah.
So there's that. But then having the really strange interactions with this different Penny, where these interactions aren't romantic anymore mm-hmm. because she loves her Penny.
Yeah.
But they still are able to connect in ways that I think the rest of the group don't.
Mm-hmm.
As they're waiting to try to steal the black card, they have personal, deep, kind of vulnerable conversation. And it's just so clear that they're understanding of each other. And her being able to talk to him in a ways that the rest of the group just doesn't listen to. Because she asked the question, why are we going along with this plan? Marina killed my mother. And we're just going to give her a nuclear bomb, essentially? If they had killed Quentin's father, would this be on the table? Or killed, you know, Alice's father? I don't know. Maybe. Mm-hmm. But maybe not. And it was just, like, nice to be able to see her, even though she's feeling isolated and, yeah, just ignored, she's able to express that to Penny, who has so often been with her in that. And yet, this Penny's different. Because older Penny, you know, Penny 40, he might have been more in agreement with her.
Mm-hmm.
But this Penny has been through a lot more life and lost so many more people just in his existence.
Yeah.
So when Katie says that, well, we could use, you know, we're getting these Deweys, we could use some of them against Marina instead of giving them to her. But Penny says, where does that end?
Mm-hmm.
I came here to get away from that shit. Just where people are fighting and scrambling for magic and killing each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just, you can't trust anyone and you don't, you know. And so I think that for Katie, she would probably feel like there's a relief. Okay, someone's actually listening to me and I'm being able to have a conversation. And, like, I feel comfortable while still feeling a little uncomfortable with him. But then feeling like, but this isn't how my Penny would have responded.
Mm-hmm.
My Penny would have supported me and we could have done something together. And so she voices what I think is a huge part of her character in this story, which is, I'm tired of being the voice in the back of the room that everyone else ignores.
Yeah.
And
such a great line.
Yeah, because that has been so Katie. She was forgotten in a psychiatric hospital. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's just so much. After she had to flee break bills, nobody found her until Julia did. You know, like, it's
yep.
just, she has been so ignored. Sometimes she'll just be not be in episodes at all, you know. And like you were talking about with these characters being affected by their identities, I mean, arguably, she's the most affected
totally.
By this false identity. Because she said that Sam did whatever she thought was right, no matter what anyone else said. I think it's just, like, it's such a sweet moment between the two of them, because he, again, in a very un-Penny 40 way, Penny 23 says that maybe Sam didn't care about what anyone else thought because she was alone and you're
mm-hmm.
not. Aw, you know, because she's feeling so isolated and he's going to say, like, you're not alone. And he's listening to her. It must be so weird to have someone who's more open than the person that you were close with and that you love. And there's so many similarities, yet there's these just big differences that make it so that you can get along and you can talk and you can be close, but you still have loyalty to their other self.
Yeah.
And then I think it's such an interesting moment at the end of the episode where she turns around in the gold chair, in a blazer, and says that she took care of the Marina problem.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, she's not going along with what everyone else says if she thinks that there's something else that other people should be listening to but aren't. Yeah, I really appreciate this moment for her, because instead of accepting that people are just ignoring her, she's going to be like, fine, you want to ignore me? Ignore me, but I'm going to do what I think is right.
Yeah.
I'm not going to sacrifice what I think is right for what you think is right. Mm-hmm. Because your opinion isn't more important than mine. So yeah, I was thinking about her, like, feeling more empowered from this other self. That, sure, that wasn't my life, but maybe I can learn something from this other person. And maybe I was happier as that other person than I am now. And part of that is because of how I won't allow people to treat me anymore in this group.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really, really great look at her there at the end. Yeah, very much taking charge, you know, not going to be a side character, a silenced character, an ignored character. But, you know, now this set, which it's becoming more and more clear, this is their new set, you know, which is great. I love it. It's a great set. But it's hers. It's her apartment mm-hmm. now. And that's, I think, really, really a great way of structurally bringing her into the group, mm-hmm. into the center of the group.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's the one in the boss chair.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, why don't we close out this episode by returning to the title, which is The Bad News Bear. What do you think?
Yeah, it's great. I've never seen The Bad News Bears, so the reference doesn't
what
do anything.
What are they again?
I think it's like one of those quirky underdog sports teams, like their baseball team or something like that.
Oh, I didn't even realize it was a thing.
Yeah, it's a movie.
That's hilarious because I thought that the name was just so ridiculous. Mm. And I was like, oh, this is a great magician's title. Because, like, I didn't look it up because why would I look something up called The Bad News Bear? I didn't think that was a real thing.
Yeah, so as someone who'd heard the name but never watched the movies, I'm like, okay, the reference doesn't mean anything to me personally. Yeah. You know, it's not like Little Giants, which I watched all the time as a kid. But it is, I think, a great title because, yeah, it's obviously this bad luck bear and Quentin gets the bad news with it. So I think it's a kind of, yeah, a perfect title because it also highlights the luck of this episode, and the luck magic, I think, is one of the stars of the show, which is saying something in this amazing episode. So, yeah, I think it's a great title.
Totally. And it just, like, seems like something that Quentin would have. You know? He would get the bad news bear.
He absolutely would. Yes. Okay, well, I think that will wrap up this week's episode. So, what's happening next time on The Magicians?
So, we're going to be on Season 4, Episode 4... Marry, Fuck, Kill, where we finally find out what the quickening is.
Okay, well, thanks so much for listening to this week's episode of Geek Between the Lines. You can find links to our website, our social media, and our Patreon in the episode description. And we hope that you'll join us on Patreon so that you can attend our monthly Zoom meetups. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week. Until then,
geek out!